A note from Ron Paul, and I hope I can find this for you. Yes, I have it here. A note from Ron Paul on that matter, in which he actually, in a certain sense, stands up for Governor Romney's freedom of religious speech. From Ron Paul, in light of Governor Romney's anticipated religion speech, quote-unquote, fellow Republican candidate Ron Paul issued the following statement, quote, "We live in times of great uncertainty when men of faith must stand up for American values and traditions before they are washed away in a sea of fear and relativism. I have never been one who is particularly comfortable talking about my faith in the political arena, and I find the pandering that typically occurs in the election season to be distasteful. Our nation was founded to be a place where religion is freely practiced and differences are tolerated and respected. I come to my faith through Jesus Christ and have accepted him as my personal savior. At the same time, I have worked tirelessly to defend and restore individual rights and religious freedom for all Americans. The recent attacks and insinuations, both direct and subtle, that Governor Romney may be less fit to serve as president of our United States because of his faith, fly in the face of everything America stands for. Governor Romney should be judged fairly on his record and his character, not on the church he attends." So this is a statement of Ron Paul, not sort of taking the bait and attacking Governor Romney on the basis of his religion, rather standing up for his freedom to practice the religion of his choice. Very distinguished and classy on the part of the congressman. While we're on that, because I may forget if I don't do that now, I have been waiting for Congressman Paul to say something about the homegrown terrorism and violent radicalization prevention act, and in fact he has now issued a statement on December 5th. I'd like to read that for you because this is exceptionally important. This bill is about to make its way through the Senate, and this is as much a watershed event as the Patriot Act in the loss of our constitutional rights. From Ron Paul, quote, "Madam Speaker, I regret that I was unavoidably out of town on October 23, 2007, when the vote was taken on H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. Had I been able to vote, I would have voted against this misguided and dangerous piece of legislation. This legislation focuses the weight of the U.S. government inward towards its own citizens under the guise of protecting us against, quote, violent radicalization. I would like to note that this legislation was brought to the floor for a vote under suspension of regular order. These so-called suspension bills are meant to be non-controversial, thereby negating the need for the more complete and open debate allowed under regular order. It is difficult for me to believe that none of my colleagues in Congress view H.R. 1955 with its troubling civil liberties implications as non-controversial. Just an aside from Stephen Vincent here, one is reminded that bills like the Federal Reserve Act were passed, sort of rammed through Congress when most of Congress was away for a holiday break for Christmas vacation. We're reminded that the Patriot Bill, people were not allowed to read it. It was rammed through Congress without giving people time to actually read the bill. We're reminded that the IRS was never duly ratified by the majority of the necessary number of states, so it is therefore not part of the Constitution. All of these are just further reminders that the rules are only applied to the citizens, and apparently government and those in power don't have to apply them to themselves. Here's Congressman Paul continuing on H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. "There are many causes for concern in H.R. 1955. The legislation specifically singles out the Internet for, quote, facilitating violent radicalization, ideologically based violence, and the homegrown terrorism process, close quote. in the United States. Such language may well be the first step towards U.S. government regulation of what we are allowed to access on the Internet. Are we, for our own good, to be subjected to the kind of governmental control of the Internet that we see in unfree societies? This bill certainly sets us on that course. This seems to be an unwise and dangerous solution in search of a real problem. Thank you, Dr. Paul, for stating that. I'll repeat that. This seems to be an unwise and dangerous solution in search of a real problem. Previous acts of ideologically motivated violence, though rare, have been resolved successfully using law enforcement techniques, existing laws against violence, and our court system. Even if there were a surge of quote, violent radicalization, a claim for which there is no evidence, there is no reason to believe that our criminal justice system is so flawed and weak as to be incapable of trying and punishing those who perpetrate violent acts. This legislation will set up a new government bureaucracy to monitor and further study the as-yet undemonstrated pressing problem of homegrown terrorism and radicalization. It will no doubt prove to be another bureaucracy that artificially inflates problems so as to guarantee its future existence and funding. I will repeat that key point from Congressman Paul. It will no doubt prove to be yet another bureaucracy that artificially inflates problems so as to guarantee its future existence and funding. No doubt what the authors of the bill are hoping will happen, but it may do so at greater further expense to our civil liberties. What disturbs me most about this legislation is that it leaves the door wide open for the broadest definition of what constitutes, quote, radicalization. Could otherwise nonviolent anti-tax, anti-war, or anti-abortion groups fall under the watchful eye of this new government commission? Assurances otherwise in this legislation are unconvincing. In addition, this legislation will create a Department of Homeland Security established university-based body to further study radicalization and to contribute to the establishment of, quote, contribute to the establishment of training, written materials, information, analytical assistance, and professional resources to aid in combating violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism, close quote. I wonder whether this is really a legitimate role for institutes of higher learning in a free society. Legislation such as this demands heavy-handed governmental action against American citizens where no crime has been committed. It is yet another attack on our constitutionally protected civil liberties. It is my sincere hope that we will reject such approaches to security, which fail at their stated goal at a great cost to our way of life. Thank you, Congressman Paul, on the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act, soon to be passed into law by the Senate. Of course, there will be more on this from me, because that's a story that, unfortunately, will not be going away. Back to the San Francisco straw poll. San Francisco Democracy Federal Action, an apparently liberal Democratic group, had a straw poll. Let's see what happened. Democracy in Action, San Francisco.
Vice President Gore and Senator Clinton. In fifth place was Governor Richardson. In fourth place, former Senator Edwards. In third place, Senator Barack Obama. In second place, Representative Paul.
Okay, Ron Paul finished in second place in a contest between leading Democrats in San Francisco.
And in first place, Representative Kucinich.
Dennis Kucinich wins first place. Okay. Okay, so that's interesting. Now, you know, one gets a little bit concerned when Democrats are almost too supportive of Ron Paul because we're trying to win the Republican nomination. So it does certainly raise some interesting political quandaries. But it's just pretty interesting, and certainly if we are faced with a situation where we're looking at an independent run, I think that we're pretty well set up for a victory on a third-party independent run. Just as a sort of, well, addendum to that little piece, let's listen to this.
Season for bipartisanship, but don't tell Dennis to finish that. The dark horse Democratic candidate says his first choice for a running mate is his Republican colleague Ron Paul. Why not? Both lawmakers feels like NAFTA. No word from the Paul camp if the Libertarian is interested. He's got a lot of money. But Ron Paul could bring, you know, some unique things like, you know, his great web fan base and maybe even a Nevada brothel owner or two.
Okay, well, I'm not going to really say what I would like to say about that news reporter's comments there at the end, because I think you might have your family listening, you know, children, and I like to try to keep it clean here, but never missing a chance. Do they in the media to poke fun and deride Dr. Paul? And, of course, that brothel owner thing that our good friend, Mr. What's his name, the news reporter who brought the brothel owner to a Ron Paul press conference, Tucker Carlson, yes, our good friend, the so-called libertarian who set Ron Paul on the campaign up for that media fiasco. Thanks so much. Let's see. So we've pretty much taken care of the straw poll issue. Now we're on the theme of polls and straw polls. Okay. On the theme of polls and straw polls, we do have yet another Ron Paul victory in a straw poll. And not that that's news anymore. I mean, let's face it, when was the last time he didn't win a straw poll? But this is in North Carolina. He won 53.7%, so get a little piece on that. December 6, 2007, Young Republican straw poll, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Come to our meeting during the year. Exactly. Woo! All right. Let's get
down to business.
Let's talk about the vice presidential race. 16% were undecided.
We're doing a top three.
Yeah, top three. Mike Sanford came in second. Tied with Ron Paul for second. And then Rudy Giuliani came in third, vice president.
Ron Paul, 53.7%. So I'm going to go ahead and sorry about the quality of that clip. Now, on the issue of polls, here's an interesting piece about Ron Paul being censored in telephone polls. So let me play that for you now. Now, we all suspected that there's something up with these polls. So here's a little piece of evidence. Phone opinion poll for the Republican presidential primary.
Hello, this is IMC Polling, calling with a one-question opinion poll regarding the 2008 Republican presidential primary.
Okay. What do you want me to say?
Your primary election was held today. Who would you vote for? Press 1 for John McCain. Press 2 for Rudy Giuliani. Press 3 for Fred Thompson. Press 4 for Mitt Romney. Press 5 for Mike Huckabee. Press 6 for other or none of the above. Press 7 to no longer receive these types of calls.
Thank you. The number we contacted you on will be removed from any future messaging list. We apologize for any inconvenience this call may have caused. Goodbye.
So, first of all, there's no option to press Ron Paul, and when he pressed 6 for other, he was told that he would be removed from the poll. So, what's up with that? Pretty interesting. First,
press
interesting
seven
that he's
to
not
no
listed.
Longer receive these types of calls.
And, here. Enough of that. So, pretty interesting. A little bit of evidence that something fishy with these polls, as we all have known and suspected. So, a little bit of controversy going on right now about Ron Paul and his interview with Newsweek magazine. So, I'm going to play you some stuff about Ron Paul on Newsweek magazine, a live interview with him. Now, I don't know if this was an interview done to create the basis for an article. I'm not exactly sure. This just hit the web, but we're going to check this out and see. I've only spottily watched this, but we'll check it out and talk about it.
Hi, this is Howard Fineman of Newsweek. I'm here at Newsweek headquarters in New York, and the presidential campaign found its way through here today as we had an interview with Dr. Ron Paul, who's making noise in New Hampshire and on the internet with his libertarian-oriented Live Free or Die campaign. And the interesting thing to watch for in what Ron Paul has to say in these interviews is his criticism of both Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney, the leading contenders now in Iowa. And Ron Paul was very interesting on that topic and very critical of both candidates. What did you think of Mike Huckabee's strategy in Iowa, where he has an ad talking about himself as a Christian leader? What's your view of that kind of campaigning for office?
Well, it's something I wouldn't do. I wouldn't use that language. I consider myself a Christian, and I hope my Christian values reflected my character and what I believe in. As a matter of fact, it has some influence, like the Christian just war theory. That's important to me. Mm-hmm. But I don't preach. I don't go out and say, if you don't agree with me on foreign policy, I'm the Christian leader, and imply that you have to follow me. I don't like that approach.
Do you think that's the implication of the Huckabee ad?
I didn't
vote for me because I'm a Christian?
I didn't see the ad, but maybe that's a subtle message from my indirect interpretation.
Yeah. Do you think it's a good idea or necessary for Mitt Romney to give a speech about Mormonism and the role of his faith in his life and in the country as he's planning to do this week? Do you think that's necessary or good?
I think it's tragic that he has to, because I think it should be irrelevant. The only thing that should count is his honesty, his integrity, his defense of the Constitution in the positions he holds, and what he thinks about foreign policy and these other things. But a religious test should never be used, and that's more or less what the people are saying, or at least the pundits are saying, you better do it. You know, they kept saying, when are you going to do it? So he's been a lot of pressure put on him. Politically, it might become necessary. Certainly, Jack Kennedy thought it was necessary to talk about it. But I think that is a reflection of intolerance of the people, demanding and putting pressure on them to do that. So I myself, I'm not interested in what he says about, you know, his religion. I want to protect his religious beliefs. So I want to treat him like everybody else. I want him to have freedom of choice. If it in some ways was a strong reflection of how he would manage government, then it becomes important. But I don't think that's what's pushing him into this speech.
Besides the punditocracy forcing him into it, isn't it also true that as the battle is waged for the support of evangelical Christians, that Mike Huckabee is basically saying, look, I'm the Christian candidate, indirectly raising questions about whether Mitt Romney shares enough of their theological beliefs to be supported. Isn't that what's going on?
I think there's a bit of that going on, but I think it's looking deeply into the motivations. I think factually you could interpret that way. I don't want to be totally judgmental and know exactly what they're thinking, but I still think, since I was not too enthusiastic about the ad that Huckabee has, I'm not too enthusiastic about the need for Romney to have to make that statement, and I wished we were talking about non-interventionist foreign policy, the Federal Reserve System, the income tax.
I know.
That's where I think we should be.
Okay, now you say that the United Nations should not exist or the United States should not support the UN. Let me ask you a question. Do you think the Jewish people are entitled to their own homeland in Palestine, which was created as a result of a United Nations resolution?
I think the way it came about is part of the reason they've been fighting there, you know, for 50 years, and they continue to fight because it's an artificially set up. The same way that Iraq was artificially set up by the League of Nations, you know, the Versailles Treaty, and we're suffering the consequence of that. But as far as their right to have a nation, you know, that's them for them to determine, you know. The Jewish people are there, and they've made their claims. It contradicts the rights of the Palestinians. But my point is not so much that I know absolutely what is right to solve that. Is it's not my responsibility, nor to tax you to do it. And I think the example you use is a perfect example of how the United Nations create problems.
Well, let me just ask you the question again. Do you think the Jewish people are entitled to a homeland of their own in Palestine?
Just as much as the Palestinians have a right to their homeland, but the details of it is not for me to determine, or the lines. I'm not in the business of drawing lines over there. I'm in the business of preserving liberty here and defending the Constitution, providing for a strong national defense, and staying out of entangling alliances. And I might have a personal opinion, and I think everybody has a right of self-determination. That's my personal opinion. But I don't have a right to use your money or your kids to go over and impose my perception of what is best for the world. I think that's when we get into trouble.
Right. So if there were side-by-side Jewish and Palestinian states, you'd be okay with that?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of people in Israel that supports my position. I mean, there are a lot of people in Israel think they should, you know, the Israelis should talk to their enemies. And the Arab League has made overtures to Israel where they've offered some peace treaty recognition of Israel. That's what would happen if we would just get out of the middle of that. And quite frankly, I don't think Israel is ever under threat, even without our promises. I think economically we make them dependent on us, and I think militarily they become dependent on us where they lose their sovereignty to us. And but, you know, now we have found out that Iran isn't even close. They haven't been working on a nuclear weapon for 4 years. I mean, why should we be getting ready to go to war over there when it doesn't even exist? But even if they did have, let's say Iran had 3 nuclear weapons and we weren't there, do you think it would frighten Israel? I don't think so for a minute. Israel can take care of herself.
How practical is it really to suggest the abolition of the entire IRS? I mean, I'm sure that's real popular in some parts of New Hampshire and some other places and with a lot of people. But come on. I mean, we have the whole system built on tax deductions and tax credits, some of which you support under the current system.
Yeah.
How realistic is it really?
Well, I think what is not realistic is continuing with what we have now, because there's a lot of tax rebellion going on in this country. You know, you'll see statistics every once in a while, like $10 billion or $20 billion wasn't collected last year. To me, it's very impractical, and it's going to come to an end. So I want to do something more practical and talk about a size of government that can exist without an income tax, and I think it's possible.
Well, in percentage terms, how much smaller would you want the government to be? Just roughly. You want to cut the federal government in half?
Well, that's
more than half?
Some people have estimated that we depend on our income about 40% from the income tax. You know, we get a lot of other revenues. Well, let's cut the government by 50% and put 10% against our deficit. And people would have more freedom, less regulation, a lot less taxation, and the economy would boom.
Well, you talk about the underground economy, but if I understand some of what you've said correctly, you don't mind tax resistors. I mean, you tell them, look, you're going to face the consequences. You're going to face penalties or jail or whatever.
Right.
But isn't it a kind of odd position for a sworn member of Congress to say, hey, I don't mind tax resistance? Aren't you encouraging the underground economy that you're then saying is the reason
we need
to abolish the IRS?
I don't think so. But when you ask me, or somebody like you ask me, you know, I answer truthfully that civil disobedience is a legitimate tool in a free society. And but you have to suffer the consequences. I don't go and preach that that is what we should be doing. Matter of fact, that's why I'm in politics, because I'm not practicing that type of civil disobedience. And probably at one time in my life, 30 years ago or so, I thought, well, this is an atrocious system. And I had a choice to make. Should I try to change the system or defy the system? And I made the choice to try to change the system. But if you ask me if I think the tools of Martin Luther King and Gandhi are good tools to challenge on principle, I mean, these are heroic people. So
the people who don't pay their taxes on principle are heroic people in the manner of Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
I think if they're defending the Constitution and they know what they're doing, and this money is supporting some real evil in the world, preemptive war, I mean, that's pretty evil as far as I'm concerned. And so much waste in a system of government that is just overrun our liberties. Yes, I think that in many ways it's heroic for people to willing to risk their freedom in order to defend what they believe is freedom. It's just that I do not promote it and I do not participate.
Got it. As far as I understand it, you're okay with people owning any kind of personal weapon they want, machine gun, semi-automatic, fully automatic. Am I right about that?
Is there
any limit on guns
sure.
or weapons for people that you would support?
Sure. The Second Amendment means the federal government can't interfere with your right to have a weapon and defend yourself. The type of weapons weren't defined, of course, in the Constitution, but if you live next door to me and I thought you were working on a 500-ton bomb, I would say, you know, there's a clear and present danger. So there's a limit, but if you're building a big bomb next to my house and I know about it, I might ask the officials to get a proper search warrant to find out if you are, because you know, this could be very dangerous, and you're not just holding a gun in your house in case somebody would come in and rob you. So I think, and hopefully that could all be done locally. You know, I don't want the BATF marching in your house without a search warrant to find out what you're doing.
Well, should people be allowed to own machine guns?
Well, that's an automatic rifle, essentially. Yeah, sure.
Well, not just an automatic rifle, but an actual machine gun.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a practical issue. I mean, I'm not advocating that, and I don't know how many people own them. But, you know, when machine guns were outlawed, I guess, you know, when we had Prohibition, you know who had the machine guns? So, I'm not pushing that, but if somebody happened to own a machine gun and he does it because it's a hobby, I'm not going to have the federal government come in and say, oh, I don't like your hobby, you own a machine gun.
No.
But if he ever threatens violence, or it looks like he is and he's involved in crime, of course you go after the criminal that owns the weapon, because, you know, a single-shot pistol can kill you as fast as a machine gun can.
Good. So there's some segments from the Newsweek interview with Ron Paul, which apparently has become an actual article in Newsweek for the December 10th issue that's coming up. So I'm going to go ahead and read that for you, because apparently that's out now from Newsweek. And then there's a piece where Ron Paul on WorldNet Daily rebuts this article. I've only scanned this. I'm reading it with you the first time. doesn't look terribly flattering from what I've been able to see so far, but let's go ahead and have a look. It's from Newsweek, December 10th, Highway to Hell, question mark. Ron Paul's worked up about U.S. sovereignty by Gretchel C. Kovich. Ron Paul wants you to be scared. There's a conspiracy in the land, what he calls a conspiracy of ideas, to give up America's sovereignty. It's a shadowy scheme that begins with the NAFTA superhighway, quote-unquote, a road as wide as several football fields that will link Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Quote, they don't talk about it and they might not admit it, close quote, Paul said at the CNN YouTube presidential debate last week. He didn't say exactly who they, quote, are, but perhaps one can guess. Quote, they're planning on taking millions of acres by eminent domain, warned the prickly libertarian. But elected government officials aren't acting alone. There's an unholy alliance of foreign, quote, an unholy alliance of foreign consortiums and officials from several governments, quote, pushing the idea, Paul wrote in October 2006. Quote, the ultimate goal is not simply a superhighway, but an integrated North American Union, complete with a currency, a cross-national bureaucracy, and virtually borderless travel within the Union. End quote. Only it's not true. That's Newsweek saying that. The main purveyor of this broad conspiracy theory is Jerome Corsi, a co-author of Unfit for Command, the book that helped swift vote John Kerry's presidential ambitions. His latest offering is The Late Great USA, The Coming Merger with Mexico and Canada, which became a bestseller on the New York Times business list this summer. Corsi plays on growing nationalist fears. He sees a scenario in which a North American Union is born and shares a currency, the Amero. Even some right-wing standard bearers regard the fears as overblown. Jed Babin, editor of the conservative newspaper Human Events, says, I guess there are people who believe in the plan for a North American Union, but there are people who believe in Bigfoot. The evidence is out there, says Corsi. Oh, Lord. I guess I have to finish reading this. Okay, like all good conspiracies, the NAFTA superhighway is a strange stew of fact and fiction, fired by paranoia. There is a big road planned. It's called the Trans-Texas Corridor. At least they admit that much. The idea was unveiled in 2002 by GOP Governor Rick Perry. And it's true, the corridor was originally designed to be 1,200 feet wide, including a highway for vehicles, railway lines, petroleum pipes, electricity and water lines, and broadband fiber optics. It's since been scaled back slightly. A considerable swath of Texas land, perhaps as much as 500,000 acres, will be taken by eminent domain. It's also true that more than one organization wants to improve commerce between North American countries. The, quote, unholy alliance Paul speaks of is the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, SPP, well, at least they admit it exists. It was launched in 2005 by the heads of state of the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Part of the SPP mandate is to increase security cooperation against terror threats. That's what they say. It also aims to improve trade. That's what they say. But much of the homepage of the SPP website is devoted to myth versus fact. It dispels tales about a secret plan to build a superhighway. Texas officials are still trying to convince locals their $180 billion idea was not hatched to undermine American sovereignty. Controversy stalled. I'm not going to finish reading this. Okay, I think we got the idea. Let me just skip to the end. Corsi is only too happy to steer things up. That's Jerome Corsi. When the Eagle Forum, a conservative association, presented him with an award in September for courage and leadership and in protecting America's sovereignty, Corsi offered a warning. President Bush's supposed determination to force North American integration, he told the audience, could cost the GOP the 2008 presidential election. Corsi may have a conspiratorial bent, but he sure knows how to spin stories that shake up an election. At least one candidate seems happy to help him. Okay. I can't go into all the details here, but these people are in severe denial. Or, well, obviously it's not a matter of denial, it's a matter of being clearly not in touch with reality, and also clearly not, well, being a propaganda source for the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, and for the very people behind North American Union. So no surprises here. So let's go ahead and see. Now, Ron Paul did have something to say about this. In an exclusive interview with WorldNet Daily, Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul fired back at Newsweek for an article labeling the NAFTA superhighway as a baseless conspiracy theory. Quote, "It's the same old story," Paul said. "If Newsweek can't discredit the message, they have to discredit the messenger." The Newsweek article by Gretchen C. Kovach keyed off an answer the Texas congressman gave during the November 28 CNN presidential debate. Paul told WorldNet Daily, "The problem CNN and Newsweek have is that it's not just me talking about it. We have some 14 states passing resolutions to oppose North American Union and NAFTA superhighways. Amendments passed in Congress have taken away funds for North American integration projects, and Virgil Good has some 50 bills for his 50 sponsors for his bill in the House," Paul explained. "There are millions of Americans who oppose this globalist agenda." WorldNet Daily has reported the House and Senate are in the final stages of sending to President Bush a Department of Transportation funding bill with amendments removing the funds needed to continue the Mexican truck demonstration project. "Millions of Americans know about these issues and are concerned about them," Paul told WorldNet Daily. "What I was trying to say in the CNN debate is that this is not so much secret debates behind closed doors, but real philosophical differences between those who believe in globalism, including many in the top of the Democratic and Republican parties, and those who believe in national sovereignty and securing our borders." Paul emphasized he wants to deal with the world in a voluntary fashion through trade, travel, friendship, rather than through higher levels of government. There's a whole lot more here, but I could direct you to WorldNet Daily to read the full text. It's certainly a substantial amount here. There's no way I could possibly read it all. Again, this is, obviously a hit piece by Newsweek on Ron Paul and on the idea of the North American Union. So back to, back to the video we've got for you for today. There are a whole bunch of new Ron Paul ads out, and I'm going to play some of those for you. Here's something, I believe this is from a political action committee, and this is going to be put on the air in Iowa and New Hampshire. I'll play that for you.
Our campaign is all about freedom, prosperity, and peace.
I've noticed one thing about you, Mr. Paul. The people think you're a straight shooter, and you're not going to play politics as usual, and you'll be honest and sincere to them.
So who are his supporters? It's just knowledge is out there. If we look for it, you'll realize that our national sovereignty is under threat.
Republicans, the Democrats, the young people, their independents, their older people, anybody who craves change and who is disenchanted with the candidates now in the lead.
I'm the one who called your office and said I would walk across Texas if you'd run for president.
That's what his supporters call it, his money bomb.
Why don't we just open up the Constitution and read it? This country is in a revolution. They're sick and tired of what they're getting, and I happen to be lucky enough to be part of it.
Congressman Ron Paul is the only candidate running
who has never voted to raise taxes,
never voted for an unbalanced budget,
never voted against our Second Amendment rights,
never voted against our First Amendment rights,
who has consistently fought for a country
where rights are accorded to us as free individuals.
as people groups.
And where government exists to protect the privacy and property of the people.
Not the secrecy and size of government.
Vote for the Constitution in 2008.
We the people choose Ron Paul for president.
It seems that every 4 years, the role the government plays in our lives just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
And I guess like most Americans, I've just learned to accept it.
Every 4 years when I voted, I think, well, this is just the lesser of two evils.
And then I heard about a man named Ron Paul.
Who reminded me about the Constitution.
That true leaders don't promise to manage our lives.
They promise us liberty.
And now for the first time, I don't have to vote for the lesser of two evils.
I can actually vote for what's right.
Restore the Republic.
Vote Ron Paul for president.
It says, what's on your holiday wish list? Do you want our troops home? Do you want rights and privacy back? Do you want to restore the value of our dollar? Do you want to restore sovereignty to our nation? An image of Ron Paul. It's a cartoon with snow. It's like a holiday cartoon. It's really cute. Okay, and let's see. Are there any more of these commercials here? I think that's it for the new commercials. I think there's a radio commercial in here somewhere. I'll see if I can find that for you. But for listeners on bbsradio.com, we're going to wrap the show now in about 1 minute. So if you'd like to continue, I have more for you. And you can come back to... Hold on a second. All right, I'm back with you now. All right, so you can go to ronpaulfreedommessage.com, ronpaulfreedommessage.com, and continue viewing the rest of the show if you'd like to on ronpaulfreedommessage.com. And we're going to continue... There's a piece from Jack Cafferty speaking about the state of the nation, and there's a mention of Ron Paul here. I'd like to throw my vote, Jack Cafferty, for vice presidential running mate.
Wolf, call us the unhappy states of America. That's the lead in a terrific front page story in USA Today, which describes this country as a nation of discontent a full year before the next election. We as a people are unhappy with the following: the country's direction, pessimistic about the war in Iraq, anxious about the economy, today's stock market notwithstanding. Large majorities disapprove of the jobs of President Bush and the Democratic-led Congress. That's understandable. In fact, 72% of us say that we're dissatisfied with how things are going. We're now in what USA Today describes as, quote, the longest national funk in 15 years, unquote. So what kind of impact will this gloomy perspective have in 15 years, unquote? So what kind of impact? Experts suggest it could be good news for the Democrats, that those who are dissatisfied with the country's direction are twice as likely to support a Democratic candidate. The tricky part is that the Democrats control the Congress right now, a Congress that's getting the lowest approval ratings in its history. We can't stand Congress, and it's under the Democrats' control. So go figure. And whoever ends up winning the White House, well, they got the war in Iraq and health care and illegal immigration and Social Security and Medicare and the economy. Got the war in Iraq and health care and illegal immigration. What effect will the nation's downbeat, anxious mood have on next year's election? Mike writes from Florida, the people are down, Jack, because they don't really see someone who can straighten out the mess this administration has us in. Who's the right president for today to turn this country around? I have no idea, and I don't see him or her in the candidates running from either side. Jeff in Rhode Island.
Okay.